talking to Charles Amerikanian at the Jurassic Foundation on, what's the date today?
October 26th.
We'll zero in on October 26th, 1994. So I will start with that first question that I mentioned, was how you happened to become associated with KPFA.
I was living in Fresno, California from the time I was born in 1945 to 1967. And in my college years at Fresno State, I encountered...
Did you grow up in an Armenian community?
In a way, because I went to the Pilgrim Armenian Congregational Church. A lot of Armenians mm-hmm. from Boston had moved mm-hmm. to Fresno at the turn of the century. And the sermon at the church, which was a congregational Protestant church, not the Orthodox Armenian church, which is the traditional church for Armenians, was given in both Armenian and English. And I was not encouraged to learn Armenian because of the vast prejudice against Armenians in Fresno when my parents were growing up. So my parents both were born in Fresno, and I was born there as well. And I encountered at Fresno State a number of intellectual types who listened to KPFA at the home of Virgil Bixby, B-Y-X-B-E. He was the founder of a folk music festival called Sweetwater Music Festival, and he had a 50-foot antenna in his backyard on a rural street in Fresno, and he invited me over one night to listen to the station. And I had already been coming to San Francisco frequently because my parents owned a party paper store, so they would come to buy things for the store at the wholesale market in San Francisco. And so I had run across the Dancers Workshop on Divisadero Street and had gone to performances there and began to listen to them live on the radio in Fresno from time to time. So I would hear Pauline Oliveros and Ramon Sender and people like that having their music played. And at the time, there was no Fresno station, so we had to pick it up directly.
Approximately what period are we looking at now?
This would have been 1966.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and
so Charles Scheer was probably
the music director.
Because you took over from him.
From Howard Hirsch.
Oh, there was an intermediate.
So Howard Hirsch was there for, let's see, Charles was there from 64 to 67. Hirsch was there from 67 to 69 and left mm-hmm. to direct the Ford Foundation-funded New Music Ensemble of the Conservatory, which gave concerts in the Hirsch Court of the De Young Museum that were quite sensational. And so I began to listen to these programs every once in a while at the Bixby home and realized that KPFA existed and there was a station that did interesting music. And when I moved to the Bay Area, I began to listen to the station, but I wasn't terribly excited about the music programs. And I, at the time, they were announced by union technicians who simply were given scripts to read. And I don't know how long that practice went back, but I imagine quite a long way.
I was instrumental in doing it myself when I was production director, because the level of people on the air, who were mostly volunteers, was so absolutely execrable, and they couldn't even pronounce the names correctly. There weren't time slots then of people having time straight through. They were just plugged in wherever they went, and the sound was so embarrassing that and the volunteers were not just available who could even pronounce Ravel or Debussy. And, mm-hmm. and so in desperation, in shame, I started getting professional people on the air. But as you are implying, that has its own disadvantages if those people are not plugged into the music scene.
The production personnel under you then were all NABET personnel, right? NABET, the National Association.
They became so. That is, that union
after
was formed uh-huh. while I was there.
I see.
When
I arrived, there were three NABET announcers who were
Bob Bergstresser,
Dana Cannon,
Dana Cannon an announcer by then?
Yes.
Ah, all right, yes. Well, I had hired him to do cake transfers at 4 o'clock in the morning.
He would have been a good mass murderer.
Yeah, he was. Almost succeeding in killing KPFA, I understand. And I've talked to Al Silberwitz at great length about his struggles to deregister the union, and which by then, you know, only this handful of wild-eyed people was really interested in.
Well, their expectations were quite unrealistic. Well, anyway, they were the only union people at the station at the time.
Yeah, I'm bringing this in because it's very useful to have you corroborate precisely what I had from Al Silberwitz, because I'm having to study my future as the past, because when I left in 1960, at the end of 65, from then on, it's tabula rasa, and I'm having to learn all of that old history as things that succeeded me.
Mm-hmm. So I had moved to San Francisco. I was living in the Haight-Ashbury. I was going to San Francisco State doing graduate work in the Interdisciplinary Creative Arts Department, and I worked at the Sea of Records as a clerk. Do you remember that store on 9th and
Mission? Do I remember it? I kept them going.
Well, I had bought records from them while I was living in Fresno, and I had discovered George Antheil's music through the Sea of Records, buying an old 10-inch Alco record of his 4th Sonata. And I was fixated on working at that store. When I got to town, I badgered the manager until he gave me a position. And so I began to meet people who would come into the store, people I'd seen give concerts, like Robert Hughes, for example, who came in to tell me that the music director position would be open because Howard Hirsch was moving on to the conservatory, and shouldn't I apply? And I had advised many of these people on what records were new and interesting. One of the people to whom I had sold his first minimalist album was John Rockwell, who later became a music critic who championed the work of Phil Glass and Steve Reich. Mm-hmm. And
I used to serve on panels, post-opera panels, with John Rockwell when he first started
my condolences.
Yes, John's built himself quite a career.
Yeah, he did. He's just moved back from Paris to New York, by the way.
Yeah, so I heard, because he decided for some strange reason that he wanted his children to be educated in America rather than in Paris.
I don't understand exactly, but I...
That's what I was told.
Yes, that's what he told me, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact. So John also recommended that I apply. He was doing a midnight program that was a mixture of musical styles, and... I forget the name of the program, but anyway, at the time, I think Robert Moran was on the air at midnight doing a program mm-hmm. in that same vein. There were a lot of midnight weirdness mm-hmm. programs going on there when I got
all these people that my life has been tied up with for the last 20 years in one way or another, uh-huh. 25 years, almost 30 years.
Well, I went to the station at one point. I walked into Al Silberwitz's office, and he was busy doing something else, and there was an elderly woman in the office whom I was sure was a volunteer. I didn't quite know what her place was. And I began to enthusiastically show her my graphic scores, which were slightly odd. And she took an interest, and it turned out to be Elsa Knight Thompson. You know,
I could have filled that.
So,
the rest of that sentence.
So the fact that she sort of... liked me or began to be interested was very
also
important.
Always had profound respect for competence. Mm-hmm. And over the years, it was the more competent you were, the better you got along with Elsa. Mm-hmm. And the mirror image of that applies as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I must have been pretty incompetent. By the time she left, I wasn't on good terms with her.
Yes, but by the time she left, I mean, she went kind of crazy.
Yeah,
poor old thing.
She was very cranky, and she was counterproductive, and it was not a good ending. The interview continued, and then they sent me to Charles Shear's house for dinner with Charles and Lindsay to pass muster with Charles. Mm-hmm. And so Carol and
I bet it was a good meal.
I don't remember the meal.
What?
I remember making silly suggestions like, let's play all the Louisville records or all the CRI records or make a series out of that. And Charles was unimpressed, as he well should have been. But somehow he gave a recommendation back to the station that they hire me. And so Silbowitz came to me and said, look, we'll hire you on a temporary basis, on a probationary basis for a couple of months. And I said, look, I can't do that. I'd have to leave my job at the Sea of Records, and I can't afford to just go off into the ozone. And so I turned him down. And then he called me back and offered me the job unconditionally, which I accepted, but I asked him for a month off so that I could have a honeymoon with Carol, my wife. We had been married in December and hadn't had a chance to leave town. So Carol and I, getting Silbowitz's approval, left for Mexico City, and in a white Volkswagen, which broke down several times, went to visit Conlon Nancarrow, whose music we just encountered, through Gordon Mumma and the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, who had performed it recently in San Francisco.
And the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, and so we went to see this man who was very reclusive, almost hermetic, and he took us to dinner a couple of times. We stayed at a $2.40 hotel room, which was all we could afford in some strange part of Mexico City. And we really hit it off with Conlon. And he was not at that time married. He was between a divorce and his marriage to Yoko Sugiura, who's an archaeologist from Japan. So I asked Conlon if I could interview him, because I was going to be going to KPFA, and he refused absolutely. And of course, I didn't have the money to own a portable tape recorder, so I didn't have anything with me. I suggested we rent one somewhere in town or find somebody who could use one, and that was a convenient excuse for Conlon not to do it. He rarely gave interviews at all at the time. But when I came back to the station, I had not only the then-issued Columbia record to broadcast, but I also had a tape of one of his early percussion pieces, and had the contact, the personal contact with him, which resulted in later recording his music for 1750 Arch on LP and then on Vergo compact discs. But it was July 8th, 1969 that I walked into the building for my first day at work, which I later found out was Antile's birthday and also Percy Granger's, whom I did a lot of work with later. One of these funny things. And I walked into the station and I met a woman named Jan Hermes, who was the secretary to Al Silbowitz, a very tall woman. And she didn't know what to do with me, so she put me in the music office and shut the door and said, you better refile all these records. There were tons of records on the floor that had not been refiled for about a year.
This could have been the woman that Al told me at one point, when the station was in desperate financial circumstances, went into her own personal savings and gave Al a check to tide things over.
I don't know if it was Jan.
It was a secretary that he inherited that did this.
Might have been. So I was told to type out the listings for the morning and afternoon concerts, and if I did that, I would have been a great gift to the station. So I started pulling records off the shelves and immediately made lists of very obscure pieces that I had found in the library. I tended to not want to play standard classical fare, which really, I think, upset the NABET people tremendously, because they didn't like this third-rate drivel that I was programming. But I should go back and look at some of those listings now. I think it would be curious to see them. And then I began, I was petrified about...
At least they were probably by live white males as opposed to dead white males.
Yeah, there were a lot of women composers. I started doing a lot of women composers too, which was a specialty of mine. I had collected records of women composers. So I was petrified about being on the air. I'd never spoken on the air. They had hired somebody who'd never been on the radio before. And I wrote a script in September for one of my earliest broadcasts, and I did an occasional review on the air, but I started a series of radio events, which were like happenings, in which the audience was asked to respond physically in some way to whatever was being aired. And this grew to a series of some 25 events that various people, from Ann Halperin to Stan Lynetta, would program, and visual artists occasionally as well. And that was the only requirement. You could have as much airtime as you asked for, but you had to get the audience to do something physically. And there was, for example, an instance of a piece by an artist named Jim Petrillo. No relation.
No relation.
Union. Jim did a piece in which he had large chess players, people dressed as chess men, on the streets of San Francisco, and a chess game was played in the studio of KPFA, and as a move was called out, people physically moved from one corner to another in the grid of an area of San Francisco. And that resulted in lots of people coming out of their houses to find the chess players. Mm-hmm.
Through the looking glass.
Right. We also had a piece by Ann Halperin in which she played a sequence of progressively more raucous pieces of music, and she asked people to rearrange the furniture in one particular room in time to the music, and then to call in at the end of the program. So while we played Image, or some evocative orchestral piece by one of the Impressionist composers, we listened to the sounds of people giddying in their explanation of how they had broken a lamp while they had rearranged the sofa and so forth.
The Infernal Dance of King Kachi should produce some interesting results.
What is that piece?
It's from the from the Firebird Suite.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the all hell breaks loose movie.
Right.
The Firebird.
I didn't know the title.
Or not
of
the
it.
Suite. Or the whole thing.
Right. Well, she got some great results from that, and there were a lot of other pieces that of that type. And that, oddly enough, from my point of view, seemed to make no impact at all on the audience. I never got a letter about it, right? Very few responses. But lots of my arts friends had been tuning in and listening. So unbeknownst to me, this had gained some momentum as an idea for the use of the medium.
There must have been considerable challenge in translating or conveying such activity by way of a microphone, in effect, to a radio audience.
Well, we use the folio as a tool. So the instructions and maps and various ideas about the piece would be printed in advance, and people would be asked to go to the Berklee Art Center or Mills College or someplace and do something. And
did you record any of the happenings that took place? You did.
Yeah, we made tapes of all of them there in the library. It was an idea that I had because of my interest in happenings that I had been reading about but not attending in New York. I'd seen a lot of Fluxus materials come my way, and I had been corresponding with Dick Higgins, and I was very interested in what was going on in this crossover between the visual arts and music.
All that stuff that Capro documented
exactly.
In his book.
And that was how I generated this idea. At the same time, one of my customers at the Sea of Records had been Clark Coolidge, who is a poet who virtually single-handedly started the language poetry movement, which is a movement in which words are used as materials rather than for their meaning. Mm-hmm. So it's an offshoot of Gertrude Stein's idea of conversation cubed. But I think really what... I met this wonderful poet whose father was the chairman of the music department at Brown.
Sound poetry you're talking about.
No, he didn't do sound poetry.
No, but you were getting involved.
I was later, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's right. You hadn't yet become a sound poet at the time that you went started
at KPFA?
Oh, yes, no,
I had. I did that from 1965 onwards, but I asked Clark to do a series of one-hour broadcasts, which he did from September to December of 1969. And those 17 programs are really classics. He invited people like Vito Acconci, who later became very famous for ejaculating under the floors of a gallery, under the floorboards of a gallery and doing conceptual pieces like that.
Not verbally, I presume.
No. And Vito did a piece where he ran through Central Park and counted every step as he was running with a portable tape recorder. And then Clark had a number of other people read their work for 30 or 60 minutes. And Clark himself did broadcasts in which he made tape loops of groups of words and then played the loops one against the other so that you had a kind of circulating series of, let's say, adverbs, one on top of the other, and on what essentially was a multi-channel performance.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any contact with your predecessor many, many, many years before, Henry Jacobs?
Yes, Henry called from time to time to the station and would discuss his latest project, and then he got involved in the Alan Watts tapes, and I heard from him quite frequently about that.
I spent an afternoon with him out at Point Reyes.
Oh, how was he?
He was fine. Oh, God, it was, I don't want to get started on that because I wasting
right,
the time.
Right, exactly.
After this is turned off, I'll tell you. Anyway. I keep interrupting because my life has just been so involved with the people that you're talking about and the activities that you're talking about.
Well, that's
I can't
believe there's so much crossover. That's great. Mm-hmm. It seems that KPFA, in the music field at least, tends to pick up people and, since there's no other place to go, hold them. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I don't know about the other fields. I suppose once you're involved in Pacifica as a young person, you always stay attuned to it in some way, even if it does something you don't like.
Yeah. Once you're the conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic, where do you move on to?
Yeah. Well, there isn't another place in America for people to exercise this kind of interest in radio. National Public Radio really hasn't provided that place, and occasionally you can do things as an independent producer, but it's much more satisfying to have a connection to an actual broadcast unit. And KPFA still provides that. In 1972, I went to Europe for the first time. My wife, Carol Law, had been there for a couple of years working as a service club assistant. In other words, she organized tours for the men on various German bases. And she got to see a lot of Europe and urged me to go back, and I was very reluctant to do it. I thought I knew everything about European modern music, and it wasn't very interesting to me, and I was more interested in the wacko American scene. But when I got to Europe and spent 3 months traveling around in a Saab station wagon that we bought in Sweden and then moved around with, I discovered that there was a tremendous wealth of information to be brought back to KPFA. And I noticed as soon as I started broadcasting these 50 or 60 programs that were based on interviews that I did in Europe, I had a more involved response from the audience, let's put it that way. They seemed to feel that they were getting something very, very special that they couldn't have gotten somewhere else. And I tended to, from that point on, be identified as a music director who was doing something with the station rather than just continuing old programs.
Yeah. It's interesting the way that technology influenced two totally different ways of going about music programming. Back in the days when Günter Schuller was doing his year-by-year survey of music based on American music, based on recordings, which were terribly hard to get hold of, that was enough in itself, just because it was so difficult to get those recordings. The possibility of going around and interviewing people back then just didn't exist. On tape, the machinery was so cumbersome and expensive; it was just out of the question.
Nobody at KPFA could have done it. I don't think you wouldn't have been able to spare a Nagra, although we had one or two. Mm-hmm. Nobody but the news department got to use them.
Yeah, and then you, that number of years later, did something roughly analogous to what he had done, but because the technology had changed, you were able to just expand it into a much more inclusive and really exciting sort of a format.
Yes, I had a Polish Walkman. It was a big Sony cassette machine with a loudspeaker in it.
Polish Walkman. I love it.
It was an SD-153 that was quite heavy compared to what we've got today.
Was that one of the wind-up motor jobs?
No. This is a Sony.
But it didn't wind up. Yeah, there was an EMI. This motor was actually spring run. You had to wind it up.
Well, the nice thing about this one was that it did have a loudspeaker, and I could play back things to participants. Mm-hmm. And it was stereo, which was wonderful, too, as I recall. As I recall, it was stereo. I'm not sure that's the one I took then. Well, anyway, let's say that I did. I think... No, there was one before that. Okay, so it wasn't that model. It was something earlier. But I did a lot of interviews with sound poets, and I discovered that there was a very large culture of sound poetry in Europe, which I wasn't aware of.
Were you around England?
Yeah, of course. I went to see Bob Cobbing and Albert Chopin. Mm-hmm. And I did an interview with Chopin at Essex, at Ingate Stone.
Did you get Clive Fancott?
No. Oh. No, I didn't meet many people in England. Mm-hmm. I didn't have much time there.
I don't know if I told you that, but Bob Cobbing and Clive Fancott and I had a sound poetry and electronics group going for several years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Called Oral Complex.
that's great.
Which was with the two of them.
It's O-R-A-L?
O-R-A-L, yeah. And the two of them working both separately and together. And we would get together in a pub and plan the program, which consisted only of selecting a title, no further rehearsal involved.
And just free improvising.
Yeah, that was just two things fixed. If there was a text, the text would be fixed, whether it was a poem that one of them had put on paper or a scrap of paper or a blank paper or whatever it was. And we would also decide upon the specific electronic treatments that would be used in that piece so that a whole program didn't start sounding like the same thing over and over and over again because the same treatments were being applied to it. But that was all that was pinned down. And the rest of the preparation consisted of getting through as many pints of Guinness as we could
during the performance
before it began. I've got a number of recordings that I made of
these. Well, when you issue the CD, I'll listen to it. Because then I'll know they're well selected. So the sound poetry of business, the fact of being in... The reason I went was that I was invited to Sweden to perform at the 5th annual Fylkingen Festival. And that... the result of my research in Europe, which went through all the major countries, because we just drove to all of them and met everyone we could, was a compilation, an American LP, which was called 10 plus 2, 12 American Text Sound Poets. And these were, or pieces, I guess, and these were things that I had broadcast on KPFA and gathered for KPFA, but actually came out on the on the LP in 1973, I think. So it was the first American anthology that was really an interesting grouping of American poets. And so the interesting thing is that all this has an eventual effect. Henry Kaiser, who's now well known as a free improvising guitarist, grew up listening to these programs and began to become interested in music, and although he was guided into an economics education at Harvard, turned out to be an unrepentant free improviser and musician. And Pamela Z, who is a composer and performer of vocal music that's modulated electronically, who lives in San Francisco, also was a listener to the station. And there were many similar stories, and I'm sure this happened all through the history of Pacifica, that people who were only vaguely interested in the arts became sidetracked into them because of the availability of the material.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's certainly been a recycling process that's gone on through the station of people who have learned from it, gone out, done things, and then come back and become involved in the station. And the multi-layered sort of baklava that's built up out of all this is one of its distinguishing characteristics.
I think the 1969 atmosphere at the station was that you, from a program department head point of view, was that you had a monthly folio meeting where a big chart was laid out and everybody filled in the details, as you say, in a kind of checkerboard pattern rather than with slots that were assigned to a single people. And that was the exciting part for me in many ways. It was thrilling to be able to sell Elsa on the idea of 5 hours of Swedish electronic music and have her say, oh, all right, let's do it.
Yeah. This could be direct quote from what Charles Scheer had to say about what he considered to be one of the most wonderful things about the station, this association of professional people, competent people, getting together and making this structure among themselves out of their disparate skills and specialization.
It is like nouvelle cuisine. I mean, you're inventing combinations that don't previously exist. Mm-hmm. And I suppose...
Except the plate's a bit fuller.
Yeah. well, I think that there's something that's been lost in not being able to do that. On the other hand, there were many months in which we, out of desperation, would take programs from foreign sources that simply weren't that good and put them on the air to fill time because we didn't have good new ideas. And so it's a mixed blessing. Both systems are have their weaknesses if you don't have the good programs to use to fill them in. The offer sheet system completely broke down around 1973. This was a system for getting programs from other radio stations in the Pacifica chain. So if someone in New York did a program that they thought might be interesting to other people, they typed up what was called an offer sheet.
And I've typed up a lot of them.
It was sent to the various other program directors, and then we could say, yes, duplicate that tape for us and send it to us.
Yeah. And this was useful for me for the couple of years that I was working as a London correspondent for Pacifica after I left Berkeley, because that was the way to communicate with all of the stations with the stuff that I sent back.
Well, after the strike at KPFA, there was no use of them at all.
This is the later strike, late 60s. You're talking about?
And those early 70s.
Oh, early 70s. 74.
74.
Oh, that one.
It was the one that shut down the station for a good while.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was only involved over there for a couple of years, 66, 67. Right, doing things.
Yeah, but
I lost all contact with the station, most contact with the station after about 67.
Right, but I thought you might like to have that information for your research.
Oh, definitely.
It's not particularly about you, but about what was going on at the station. I'm trying to think. There were one of the other areas that. We developed pretty thoroughly was the idea of resurrecting a particular composer and focusing on that person. We did this with Antheil in 1970. The station sponsored a concert of his music at Hertz Hall.
Did they tend to be, on the whole, 20th century composers?
Living ones. Living.
Okay.
Antheil was an exception, but I had his widow to give me scores that hadn't been performed for 45 years. We got Nate Rubin and Lou Harrison and all these people together, and we performed the first Antheil concert of his early pieces.
Did you do any readings from Ezra Pound on Antheil?
Not at the concert, but we did in the radio broadcast. We did a series of three long ones, preceding the Hertz Hall concert. And by the time the concert came around, Hewlett-Turquie had printed a front page article on the weekly magazine of the Chronicle. And the concert completely sold out. We turned lots of people away. And we ended the program with... a film of the Ballet Mécanique accompanied by a recording of the music. But previous to that, we had slides of La Femme Sans Tête, the book by Max Ernst, projected while a piece that was literally unknown of Antheil's was performed by Julian White. It was a piece called La Femme Sans Tête, which was 45 short piano preludes that were very radical, almost like Satie mixed with Stravinsky. Very, very strange pieces. Those have since been recorded on CRI. The whole recording has been released of all of them. But these striking images were on the screen, very large, projected by Carol, who had photocopied them from a book, and that made an enormous impression on the audience, along with the violin sonata number 2 with drums, which Pound had commissioned for his mistress, Olga Rudge, and which had a drum part at the end for Pound to play, and Lou played the drums. And it was a wonderful, wonderful performance and brought the house down. And subsequently, that piece has been played all over the world and has been called a solid gold American masterpiece. And it was sitting in the woman's closet, and KPFA was instrumental in bringing this back to life.
As it were.
Yeah. And so the other person that we did quite in depth was Dane Rudyard, who was still living in Palo Alto and who became a very good friend. And Rudyard had been involved in theosophy in the 20s and had also been a protege of Henry Cowell's through the New Music Edition, and knew Cowell when he was starting up the magazine. And it was and that was in the mid-20s, I think, late 20s. So Rudyard did a series of 8 or 9 broadcasts of all of his different writings, some of which he read, others also read. And then we gave a public concert with a lot of his piano music. Anyway, this kind of thing we tended to do a lot. And one of the other things I think I'm most proud of having done at KPFA was the national broadcast in 1981 of the New Music America Festival, which was, I think, 8 consecutive nights from the Japan Center Theater in San Francisco. And it was on the satellite all over the country. So KPFA really, for the first time, did a significant national broadcast that every radio station could pick up, and we had many stations carry that event live every evening. It was an awesome amount of work. And there were great numbers of people who got in contact with the station after that and said, "Bravo, this is terrific." And so the next year I hosted the broadcast from Chicago when WFMT wanted to do them but didn't have anybody who was involved in contemporary music who was interested in doing it. So my wife was teaching at the Art Institute that semester. And I moved to Chicago, and it happened to coincide with their planning for the festival. And then when they actually did it, I flew back and announced them. That festival occupies a particularly strong place for 10 years in the history of American music. And since you weren't here, it might not sound so profound, but it was the first manifestation, I think, of a new generation of composers making their mark on the scene. Laurie Anderson and people like that.
Sort of music's armory show.
Yeah, it was, in a way. And when you consider that most of these composers were the chief honchos of minimalism, which now has lasted longer than impressionism in the history of music, and has become much more significant as an influence than impressionism, It is, I think, an important point of reference. There was a broadcast I did in 1984 also that was called Vox Pop Verite, in which during the election, or the months leading up to the 84 election, you'll recall then that we had Ronald Reagan up for his second term. And the station was trying all sorts of things that were legal to tell the world how bad the first term had been. But this was the one that ended up getting the most attention. We put a microphone on Shattuck Avenue at 12 noon on Monday and Thursday for a half hour and left it open for anyone to speak into. And it was an enormous controversy within the station between the public affairs director, Philip Maldery, and myself about whether or not we should be allowing the public to have access to the airwaves to do this. Because his feeling, I think, was...
Was this a mic that was on air?
On air, yeah, live on air.
So straight out.
Yeah.
Ah, right. Any tape delay?
None.
So no effort to shield against obscenity?
Right.
Okay.
We didn't have any obscenity, as a matter of fact. Nobody even got close to it.
The only obscenity that was uttered was Ronald Reagan.
The The interesting dynamic that occurred, and I had heard about a project like this in Amsterdam that was a city radio project with a limited broadcast range, where a microphone would be on all the time for 24 hours and people could go up and talk and others could listen.
Is this comparable to that, what they're calling micro radio at the moment, small transmitters with a very limited
range? No, this was a really large range. It was the whole city of Amsterdam. It was not just a few blocks. But I wanted to try this, and this seemed to be the good time to do it. And what happened was we put up a large cloth awning-like sign outside the station saying live on the air, 12 to 12:30. And people started lining up the first day, one or two, and speaking. And we got through the theme music and went down live to the street. And people started talking. And it was quite interesting. Somebody had lost a cat. There were a few other things, but mostly it was about the election.
Was anyone sort of standing in attendance on the microphone?
Yeah, so it wouldn't be stolen. We were about 25 feet away. Mm-hmm. But we weren't guiding people. The point was not to guide them. Mm-hmm. So
was there a sign or something telling what was happening?
Just a sign saying that this mic is live on the air from 12 to 12:30. Mm-hmm. Please. Say what you want, but it didn't guide them in their presentations. But what happened was, interestingly enough, the first day there wasn't much activity. The second day, on a Thursday, there was more activity, and the third day people started lining up to use that microphone and started monitoring each other, saying, "We're not going to speak for more than 2 minutes each now." And then by the fifth day, there was a vast line. It was amazing to see this progression. By the fourth broadcast, I believe it was the fourth, we had national television news programs covering the fact that we were giving people the right to free speech, which we thought was guaranteed by the First Amendment.
And not that way. They
not
didn't that mean
way.
That.
They didn't mean that. Well, can you imagine that this was news, that somebody would do this? It hadn't struck us how newsworthy this was, in fact. But we had the three major networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, there with their television cameras covering this. And then they did interviews with various of the staff members about why we were doing this broadcast.
Yeah. That sort of thing would work better in Berkeley than it would in a lot of places. There are so many people in Berkeley whose mouths are on autopilot all the time.
That's right. I think that's right. And, of course, we got that sort of treatment from the networks. This is the crazy Berkeley scene and where anything can happen.
Berserkly.
But I'll tell you, the shock to the station was that there were no terrible bits of profanity. There were people reading poetry. Some people prepared little skits. But by and large, there were people talking politics and reading poetry or singing or doing something.
Was there a sprinkling of nutters?
Yeah, there was a religious woman who came up and gave us the right-wing Christian point of view on everything and told us how to activate our beliefs. And then there was a man who accused his landlord of having brutally evicted some people, and that was actionable, and we had to call the landlord and give him an opportunity to reply on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
the only instance?
That was the instance that really worried the station.
My goodness, to have only one. What was the date again?
This would have been 1984, just before the election, so maybe September, October. Oh.
God, I suspect one would get a lot more violence now if one did the same thing.
No.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think. You mean in Berkeley?
Mm-hmm.
Possibly.
Right. Okay, anyway, getting back to what you...
I just wanted to say that about this dispute between me and the public affairs director was interesting, and it's emblematic of the typical disputes that happen at KPFA over art that is perceived as art for art's sake rather than art for the betterment of society in literal terms. Philip Maldry, who's the public affairs director, said that he didn't feel it was proper for us to allow people to speak without being monitored because there should be station responsibility for views that get out on the air. And if somebody said something that would be racist or sexist or for example, that should be disclaimed by the station immediately, or modulated, modified. And my point of view was that if somebody did that, that two speakers down the line, you'd have the answer from somebody else, which in fact is what happened in cases where people were inappropriate in some ways. And it was just a different point of view.
Well, Elsa put it very eloquently and very briefly long ago. Balanced programming, she said, is not considering and dragging somebody in to say yes every time somebody else says no.
Mm-hmm. Especially when all the networks have people that only say no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I also like to have people dig their own graves during the course of an interview. And she would draw them out.
Hang themselves at will, as she said.
And that was a great lesson to learn. Indeed.
Yeah.
She would say.
Elsa in her prime was a great broadcast.
I wouldn't know.
She was.
Tell me. Oh, sometime.
Oh, yeah, I will sometime. So now you, I take it, were intimately involved, if not the instigator in this open microphone.
Yes, thing. I was the producer, and I conceived of the idea and had to sell it to the program council, which was not unanimously in favor of it. One of my allies in a lot of these experiments was, interesting enough, Barry Scott, who's the director of the Third World Department. She is... has had a lifelong interest in avant-garde jazz, and she always was interested in using the medium in a different way and was very creative about that and always very supportive. And Eric Bauersfeld, of course, as well, who always saw the bright side of every possible creative act. And so those were my allies in putting this forward. And I think...
You and Eric both got fired at one point, didn't you, in the midst of some brouhaha or other for a short period?
No, Eric left the station to work at KQED, but neither of us was actually fired from the station. But we did, we were involved in the strike in 1973. Oh, Eric actually was briefly fired. I take that back. I believe he was.
I read in print somewhere, which doesn't mean necessarily that it's true, that you were both... For a very brief period.
No, I was never fired from the station. But I believe Eric was for a bit. Be curious to know where you read that. Was I starting to talk about the strike in 73? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The strike that occurred in 74, which was just at the time that Nixon resigned, so it would have been August, was perpetrated by... a couple of things. Dissatisfaction with Roger Pritchard, who was the manager at the time.
Was he the Englishman? Mm-hmm. Yes, that mild-mounted gentleman who described to me as terribly nice and not having a foggiest idea what was going on.
And the other problem that arose was the activities of the people that formed the Third World program at KPFA. And they're wanting to get involved in the station and have airtime allotted to them. Mm-hmm. My view toward that was that they should be given the same access that anybody else would, based on their competence to do a program. And the feeling at the time was that we should let them have program time without having practiced or having done actual radio broadcasting. I think it was partly a stylistic thing, partly a feeling on the part of Eric and me and some of the other people at the station that it was not a favor to the audience or the community that you were trying to reach to put on a bad program. And we repeatedly pointed to Chairman Mao's Red Book when it said that bad art did not make a revolution. Mm-hmm. But the fact was that people were not getting on the air for one reason or another who were people of color, and they needed to have the access. And gradually the people who were dissatisfied and who were volunteering in other capacities at the station joined together with those who were upset with Pritchard's management style. And they fomented a strike, which at one point during a very heated meeting, Eric and I actually threatened to break because they were threatening to lop us off as future participants in the station. If we didn't do so-and-so, then we wouldn't be with them when they won the strike. Mm-hmm. And Eric and I sat up all night calling people and getting enough people to vote not to strike, to break the strike, that it stunned the staff members into respecting the artists.
Yes, Eric told me about this calling a vote on the strike, and suddenly people found their throats slit without even realizing that there was a razor present.
Well, it was a real something that, whether they liked it or not, gave the political people who were not thinking of all the ramifications of what they were doing a kind of reality check. And I think it helped us later because it made them respect our they hated us for it at the time, but I think they had to respect the fact that we could be political too and just as effective.
There's a chronology of that sequence of events which Vera Hopkins drew up language which sounded rather emotive to me as I read it. I don't know how accurate it was, but she talked about an invasion of the station and a physical invasion of the station and
during the strike when we weren't supposed to go in. Or
I've forgotten exactly as I've just skimmed through it, but at some point invading the manager's office or something and sort of holding him hostage and. It's events of that kind that she's talking about, and
I think that might have happened.
Yeah,
I can't recall.
And David Solniker's involvement with the station, I learned, was in the first instance as being the legal representative for this Third World contingent,
mm-hmm.
He referred at one point in our interview to the alleged invasion, which is that lawyer's careful word that one uses, the maybe, maybe not word.
Yeah. I don't remember which incident, which invasion he's referring to, which alleged invasion. There was the invasion of the control room, which was quite serious. A man with a gun came into the control room and wanted to take over the air.
Was this part of the Third World contingent?
Mm-hmm.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. Right. And he was a very docile volunteer who had worked for me in the music department for years, a very charming guy. But then they had to defend him against a lawsuit from the station, as I recall. So David must have defended that case.
Uh-huh. My God. What brought him to that?
I think frustration with not getting the respect he wanted or not getting the airtime. I don't recall.
Would you like to comment on any changing attitudes towards music programming over the years that you were there? Not by you necessarily, but by the rest of the station and rest of listeners. Do you feel that music began to play a different role in the life of the station?
There's the idea of music as entertainment, which I didn't foster, and which gradually crept into the operation of the station when airtime was given out piecemeal to various people on a regular basis. And by and large, it has resulted in some fairly interesting developments. We have a biweekly program now on bluegrass music, which you wouldn't imagine could sustain itself over the course of years and years, but does, because the field of bluegrass music has changed so radically that it's been influenced by minimalism and electronics and all sorts of other impurities. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for virtually all kinds of popular music which are aired on the station. So that you'll hear a rap piece which is based on a Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan record. And you'll just wonder, how did these rappers discover this ethnic musician? And I think what's happened now is that there's this grand mixture of things going on that makes potentially interesting any subject in music. So whereas years ago, having a straight program on a particular popular music topic wasn't so interesting, now it potentially can be. The only difference is that a lot of the broadcasters in non-classical music are very ill at ease with actual terminology of music and simply can't explain musically or don't care to know or explain what is going on in the music that makes it interesting. And this, I think, weakens the impact of the broadcasts. And although you don't have to analyze every single country and western song you broadcast, it would be interesting to show tendencies. And there are certain broadcasters who were able to do this, to refer to a picking style or refer to how a particular form of the blues was influenced by radio broadcasting in the 30s, so that people from one town to another actually changed their style based on what they heard on the radio. That kind of information is present in about a third of the programs, but not in the other two-thirds. And it leaves you with the feeling that you might be listening to a commercial station.
Yes, indeed. I've done a lot of listening the few weeks that I was there, and more towards the end when I changed cars to one that had an FM radio in it, as I just had it there all the time, just traveling back and forth. And what surprised me, I have to admit, is that virtually, well, I'd say 90% of what I listened to, I would have left turned on, even if I hadn't had an object for having it on, doing research, as it were. Just out of my own personal interest, I would have played it. And I was surprised with how much interesting stuff I heard. Part of what annoyed me, I found I had to go through, which was that very often it was intelligence masquerading as stupidity. Stupidity, too strong a word, but a conscious populism of people whose brains were not necessarily populist. Now, Larry Bensky, I interviewed at great length. I went in a little bit apprehensive about that because I know his reputation, and if he thinks that you're really not up to it, he can have you for breakfast. but I had a good session with him, and in the course of which, I have to say, he said he had just read my little monograph on the first 10 years, and he said that it was, I'm careful in my precise quotation, that it was at an entirely different level from anything else that he had read on the subject of KPFA in its early history, and would I mind if he used it as an assigned text in his course that he teaches on the media, and that if it continued along the same lines, that it would be the definitive history of KPFA. And then he thrust upon me the name and address and telephone number of his literary agent in New York. So I guess he kind of liked it.
Wow, that's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, as I say, he scared me. To me, he is the brain of a Talmudic scholar disguised as an aging hippie. There's a lot of intellectual power there.
Yeah, it's true.
And he is somebody that the station would not have been ashamed of on the air at any moment in its history.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I think one of his most virtuosic performances, he was a college hockey player, was his broadcast of a hockey playoff game that the Oakland whatever they were, seals or whatever they were, got into once in the mid-70s. And George Craig mic'd it in stereo so that you could hear the puck going from one end to the other. It was the most brilliant motor mouth performance I've ever heard Bensky do, because he literally described every step of the action. And in brilliant, brilliant fashion, better than any sportscaster I've ever heard. And it's a pity that...
Even Bob and Ray filling in the early days in baseball in Boston.
I didn't hear that.
That's where they got their start.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And when things weren't going on, they'd start making them up.
The Braves or the Red Sox? It was the Braves. They'd have to make something up. That was undoubtedly one of my favorite moments on KPFA, hearing us do a sports broadcast with high-quality sound in stereo from a local arena with a professional playoff game that nobody else wanted to cover.
Does that exist in recording?
It should. Yes, there were two 10-inch reels of that somewhere. Mm-hmm. Larry might know if it exists.
I'll talk to him. Because one of the things which I have decided on this, and others have decided for me as I've gone along, is that this really must come out either or alternatively in the form of a CD-ROM. Or with accompanying CD or CDs in order to give excerpts from the programming over the whole of this period.
You could have a wonderful, just a bloopers CD. It would be colossally funny.
Well, that's so easy to do. I had made one decision already, which is that I intend to look only for the best of KPFA's programming, not the worst, because you can do the worst on anybody. You can do the worst on the BBC and come up with some astounding things.
You know, when we opened our new building, by the way, we did a live satellite broadcast of the event, and Lou Harrison was commissioned to write a piece for the opening of the building, and that's since been released on a Music Masters compact disc. I can give you the cassette of it anyway. It's inside here if you don't have it. But that was a wonderful moment too.
Well, it's the broadcast ice hockey thing immediately comes to mind. What a wonderful thing to have a few minutes of.
Yes, fabulous. I would love to hear it myself again, just to see if, just to confirm my memory of it.
Because it needs to be a really eclectic. I'd love to produce a montage, Charles Scheer type montage of the broadcasting of KPFA.
That'd be great.
From 1949 to the present.
It's a wonderful idea.
And the thing about CDs, of course, is that you don't have to have announcements. Because
index
numbers tell you everything you need to do, and you could just do pure collage. And if you want to identify, what was that? Look at the number. All right, it's down here.
John, that's wonderful. Do you know about the exchange we did with the Dutch radio station, where some of our staff went there and vice versa?
No.
We did an exchange with VPRO.
Was it Hilversum?
Yeah. Well, there are seven stations in Hilversum, or there were at the time. There are nine now. But with radio station VPRO, Free Protestant Radio Company.
Oh, I see.
But VPRO is the most radical station in Holland. It's the one that makes fun of the Queen and does broadcasts of... on television. They have a television station and a radio station. They were very small when we had an exchange. Larry Josephson and I and various other staff members went to work there for months at a time, and then they would send a public affairs or a music person to our station. And our experience with that was tremendous. I was there for 5 months in 1973-74 and did 50 programs on the history of American classical music from Benjamin Franklin's time to the present, and it was a.
Did you take things off of disc or live performances?
Disc and tapes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have Neely Bruce's album of early American piano music?
When did that come out?
That was a Vox box, quite a number of years ago.
No, it was that was later. This was 73.
Oh,
Neely's
oh.
thing came out later than that,
was
I believe.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but I think so. Might have I don't know. Yeah. I didn't have it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had a lot of records from that Society for the Preservation of the American Musical Heritage, which had these obscure 19th century pieces, and Harry Partch private records and things like that. So I introduced literally all of these experimental composers to Europe on the radio there. There simply were no broadcasts of Lou Harrison done in Europe at all in 1973. He was an absolute unknown. And since then, he and Antheil and Rudyard and Nan Caro all were introduced by this one series of broadcasts which were heard by Reinbert DeLeo, who's now the conductor at Tanglewood in the summers of the modern music section, and who does lots of... Well, you know Reinbert DeLeo, don't you?
I don't know.
He's a conductor. He conducted a series of concerts called the Rondon concerts that were in the Carré Theater. And he does fantastic resurrections of people. So... So this exchange with VPRO was very funny. Larry Josephson, for example, studied the language so he could speak in Dutch when he went there to do his program. But he made the mistake of learning Flemish instead of Dutch. And when he got there, he was so depressed that he could hardly operate.
Oh.
And then we did a couple of exchanges with public affairs producers coming to our stations. And then they decided that it would be better to have the music people go because there's not such a great language difficulty. So then Han Reisiger, who is the VPRO music director, came to work at KPFA after swearing he would never come here because people were killed in the streets, and he knew this from seeing American television programs on Dutch television. So the understanding and the bond between the VPRO and the Pacifica stations became really strong in the mid-70s, about the time Allende was killed. I walked into work one day in November and saw everybody staring at me with these angry looks, and I said, what is going on? They said, do you know what your country has just done? this kind of thing. And so I began to understand international politics from a completely different point of view, and I was astonished to see that liberals and radicals in Holland had no compunction about taking their holidays in Spain during Franco, which surprised me. They talked pretty big, but when it came to push came to shove, they couldn't give up the coast. but this was a very valuable thing because it gave us actual experience working in the European context, which, as you know, is much more professional.
Mm. And I'll bet they didn't turn off their televisions when Dallas came on either.
I doubt that they did, but they might have used it for parody on the VPRO.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, now the VPRO is one of the biggest stations in Holland because the generation that grew up in the 60s is now in their prime professionally and is paying big bucks to keep that place on the air. The stations there are supported by voting. Everyone pays radio and television taxes, but you vote for your favorite station. So the VPRO is now one of the most popular. Subsequently, they've gone from having 10 hours a week on the radio to having maybe, let's say, 50. And same in the television arena. They used to have 2 hours a week, and now they have many more. So they've employed many more people for their political point of view, which operates on their shows.
Which of the Dutch stations, or is it a collective of the Dutch stations that puts out the music magazine that includes a CD?
That's from NOS, which is... the NOS is the production unit, you could say. It has all the technical people, and it has its station. The others are only a station without any technicians. So the NOS is responsible, and they gather things from all the Dutch stations to produce that show.
They had my mix of Vario Sinfonia in there for one.
What did you do to the Sinfonia?
Well, I mixed the voices.
Oh, you did the voices for that?
Yeah.
Wonderful. I didn't know that.
Yeah, do you know the disc? I mean, do you happen to have it? Or?
Well, I'm trying to think. Is this different from the piece that was released in the 70s?
Oh, well, it's the
tape accompaniment to the piece.
Oh no, there are live voices.
And
orchestra in performance.
Right.
Yeah.
And
so I mixed the voices. I amplified the voices.
In which performance?
The one which was released
on RCA?
On this disc from Dutch radio, in part of their magazine.
I don't get those anymore because I'm not at the radio station, so I wouldn't have heard that.
This was the
last thing I got from Dutch, NOS was on LP.
It's the Dutch Dutch radio orchestra. Then we did a tour.
Who was conducting? Hans Funk or
on that one? I think it was. I think it was Ada de Vet. Because I did it with him in Minneapolis.
I like him so much.
Oh God, what a fine conductor. Well, we Electric Phoenix knew him back to the days when he was the
Blazes
the,
Ensemble,
the Netherlands Wind Ensemble. I have a lot of fun with Sinfonia, because it's one of the things I do. God, I've done. I've mixed that in. I've lost track somewhere around between 25 and 30 performances with symphony orchestras around the world that I've done of that thing, and every time I discover something I'd never heard before.
Oh, that must be wonderful.
Yeah, it's a great piece of music. Anyway, I'm interviewing myself at the moment rather than you.
I wanted to say something about the earliest days when I was working at the station, because there was an atmosphere that was completely different from what you have now. It was really a sort of a 10 to 5 job, and people tended to dress quite differently. I mean, you had people wearing ties and so forth.
You're talking about the beginning.
The KPFA in 69 when I started. People got to work in the morning and they left in the evenings, and they didn't come back unless they had a program to do, but that was rare. And there was a lot of craziness after 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, programs that would go on for hours where young composers, and I was among them, would come in and just talk to the audience and read things and take phone calls and do all sorts of unusual mixes, playing all the turntables at once and all this kind of thing. In the context, one of the things that would happen would be that Elsa, who ran the weekly program meeting on Mondays, where everybody would gather and get their marching orders for the week and figure out what we're going to cover, Elsa would occasionally have need of lobbying one of us to do something, and we would be invited down to Edie's for these sessions where she would blow smoke in our face from her chain cigarette habit and dangle her red fingernails in our face and say, "We do want to do this, don't we?" She was actually very, now that I think about it, very bright about getting people to do what she wanted, because she'd take you aside and actually solicit your help. On the other hand, there was a downside of this, which is that if you didn't want to do what she said, you'd be on her bad side for a while. And I remember going days without speaking to her because I was so angry and petulant about something that she wanted me to do that I didn't want to do. But it was at first a very interesting challenge working with her. And by the time the years rolled by from 69 to when did she leave, 72 or so?
I think it was 72.
By 1971, she would do unedited interviews every night on the open hour from 8 to 9. And these things would seem interminable, and they were never edited because she didn't have the time. And I understand that now as I get older, how she wouldn't have the energy to sit around with a razor blade and chop things up. Not that she ever did, because she had technicians who did that. But the fact that she became careless about what was going out over the air, and she was satisfied that it was enough that she was in the room with somebody for an hour and this thing would be aired later, that didn't satisfy a lot of us younger
There
people.
Are so many unedited hours on KPFA now.
That's right.
There are no intention of, if you even suggested that they should be edited, you'd get a blank stare.
Yeah, exactly. It's true,
but it's just called live broadcast. Yeah. If you do it on tape, and you put it out, oh, well, I should have been edited. There's so many, so much dead space in this thing. But if the red light's on, then it's okay because you are being yourself.
Well, having a conversation for an hour on the radio is a difficult challenge enough. Mm-hmm. To do it every day without any technical assistance is just impossible.
Yeah, I was always of two minds about that. I used to join those who made their jokes about Elsa's interviews, but now that I have experienced years of the soundbite generation.
Oh, I don't like those either.
I long for one of Elsa's. And I have a lot of sympathy with something that she snorted once that anybody that's worth talking to, if they're worth talking to at all, they're worth talking to for an hour. Now that's an exaggeration. You could mm-hmm. you could shoot holes in. But as a corrective slogan for what actually happens on the radio now, there is a hell of a lot of truth in it.
I think the interviewer has to be very good, though. And it may be that the subject is worth speaking to, but it may be that the interviewer is not up to the task. Mm-hmm. And that, Elsa was not up to the task in her later years. Yeah.
When in her prime, she knew how to bring out of people what they had to say. And I can go a long ways just listening to the voice of an intelligent person, even if that person is feeling his or her way through an interview because they're talking to a stranger, and even if they haven't had time to prepare, and often you don't have time to prepare. But the meanderings of an intelligent mind are a hell of a lot more interesting than the meanderings of an idiot.
By the way, do you know Alan Hollinghurst? Or
No.
You heard about him, the English novelist who's gay, who wrote a book called The Swimming Pool Library?
No.
And his newest one just came out is The Folding Star. He's reading it for the Jurassic program. He wrote it here, and he's reading it in a salon we're doing up and coming. But apparently he's one of the really brilliant younger novelists who's about, and every interview I've read with him is one of these fascinating things that you're describing, but it's so rare to get them anymore.
Anything else that you have to say about the changing function of music on KPFA over the...
Well, one of the important functions of KPFA is that it's provided an archive of materials that is simply immeasurably valuable, and it doesn't have sufficient library help to catalog the materials. Once the materials leave KPFA and go to the Pacifica Archives in Los Angeles, they become lost. They can't be used because music rights are not available, and so people can't obtain copies. And secondly, they're not cataloged. So there is a crisis at the station right now, which is that a lot of the very good programs that we have on tape from 1960 to 1992, when I left, are sitting more or less without complete labels and catalog numbers for the last 10 years. And there are complete music festivals that have incredible premieres and so forth that are in boxes on pancakes and are not properly labeled. And really something should be done about that.
Now what happens, what were you saying happens if they go down to Los Angeles? To
the they go into an archive that is so vast and it consists of crates sitting in unmarked in garages.
What, really?
Yeah, because
God,
people do not there are no Pacifica labels for tapes anymore. The label itself does not exist. There is not a form that you type on that you affix to a box now, if you can imagine. And so I was, I think, the last person who was really trying to label tapes properly, but I couldn't keep up with the work.
God, I had gotten the impression, I think they try to convey the impression, that the archive down in Los Angeles is a great orderly...
Well, there are two parts to it. There's the deep storage, where all of our stuff would go if we gave it to them. And then there are the things they can market. They think they can market. And those things are the obvious things. Not something of interest to a scholar, for example. The other thing I wanted to point out was that when I came to the station, there were about 15 volunteers in the music department, and there, when I left, there were 82. And so the management of the volunteer staff became virtually impossible, and we were asked to do regular reviews in writing of each program participant. They all do programs because they don't do anything. They don't want to do essential work like library work or any other kinds of things. They all want to be on the air, and they all were. So that is a vast difference in that the supervisory time of the program department head was drawn off and by all of these competing forces. And so not having the funds to pay one single person to do the morning concert every week or a specific program, we relied on volunteers to fill out those things, but those programs, but you couldn't get somebody to do it 5 days a week or once a week every month, let's say. So you relied on alternating people, and that's how you ended up with 82.
Oh my God. If it was anything like KPFA as I knew it, it must have meant that you had an enormous disparity of quality.
Yeah, sure. That's true. There were people who were very intelligent about a particular kind of classical North Indian music, but weren't very good on the air and needed to practice and only got to practice live on the air. Okay. And could only grow to such a level because they didn't have proper training, because there was no time to train them, because there were 81 other people to train.
Well, my subtext of this is that I feel that that we have grown into an age in which intellectual rigor is, you know, increasingly non-existent or even looked down upon as
Oh, it was definitely looked down upon at the period of strike in 73, 74. To be even accused of being an intellectual would be the lowest cut you could have.
Competence and elitism having become virtually simultaneous.
Synonymous of the accusers, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's an effort toward insisting on competence, but I must say that I don't see the same requirements from an intellectual basis at the station, and the very saying of that is looked upon as a horrifying gaffe. Mm-hmm. But there's no other way to get around it, really. I mean, even if you don't agree with the person politically, you tend to have some respect for them if they state their case well.
Yeah. And, when I started on this project, well, when I was forced into continuing the project up to the present, just because those whom I had interviewed for the first part and who read what I had done started climbing all over my back and saying, "You've got to bring it up to date and make a book out of it." And I finally accepted that maybe this was my karma and I was going to have to live with it. I thought, now what am I going to do? Because this is likely to be melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, a story of the gradual disillusion breakup and of KPFA, the great structure as we once know it, the Sphinx with its nose knocked off and so forth. During the 3 weeks, 4 weeks that I've been over here in Berkeley, I've had a turnaround on this subject, and I've came to the conclusion that there are a whole lot of different histories of KPFA that could be written. If one were to write a history of KPFA which asked the question, what has happened to the original ideals of Lou Hill, and how does the present station measure up to them, one would indeed have decline and fall of the Blue Hill Empire to set down. But if you asked another question and set out to examine how has KPFA over the years reflected the changes that have taken place not only in Berkeley society but in American society as a whole and even world culture, to what extent is it a metaphor for what has happened to the way that we think and the way that we interact? Then I think you've got an entirely different story. And I find KPFA today, for an institution which is so old, an amazingly seismic reflection of the things that are happening, the things that are going on. For all of its faults, all of its shortcomings, all of its internal contradictions, it has about it, on the air, more of the feel of an organization that was started last month than an organization that was started 50 years ago.
In many cases, the programmers have been on for just mm-hmm. 1 month, and they still have the excitement, mm-hmm. along with the naivete, that we associate with the station. But reflecting what's going on is not necessarily the mission of KPFA today.
Oh, yes. I'm not saying that this is this is what it should do. I personally prefer institutions and people that lead and examine rather than merely follow.
I guess what's happened though is that in the course of recognizing the diversity of the people who now make up the United States, and particularly Northern California, the station has been extremely responsive and continues to provide another kind of ferment, maybe not of the white intellectual pattern of the mm-hmm. 50s, but of a different kind, which is an in-your-face exposure to the unfamiliar, which results in a kind of understanding and sensitivity that is the mission of the station, to make us feel for one another a kind of bond rather than a division.
Yeah. I told you that I was driving past a couple of nights ago and heard this guy on the air that I had known vaguely through the Edinburgh Electronic Music Festival of the early 1970s stopped by the station. Waited till he came off, and we got together and went out for coffee. This is community radio in a very real sense. And in the process of doing this, I met somebody that I hadn't met, Jack Foley, mm-hmm. his name is, mm-hmm. Who's a very bright guy indeed.
Yeah.
And knows a lot about the poetry scene, and he gave me a copy of his newspaper, that poetry, whatever the name is.
USA something.
It's a Poetry Flash or something like that, and which included a review of his
book.
Perlin Getty's retrospective collection.
Right.
Which was extremely good. It was a very good review indeed.
Yeah, he's a very bright guy.
High class, indeed.
Jack was just a resident here a couple months ago and heard about the program when I took the job out here and applied and was juried in. So,
I know it's not part of this, but what goes on here?
we have a program similar to the McDowell Colony, which consists of a ranch that's on the other side of Bear Gulch Road. Mm-hmm. There are two buildings on the 600 acres. The two buildings are where the artists work. One is a big 12-sided barn that is divided off into wedges that has a choreography studio, beautiful dance studio with a glass wall facing the forest, a composer's studio with a grand piano and some electronic equipment and playback equipment, which is for a composer. We have three visual art studios, sculpture and painting studios, And then there's an artist's house, which has a dining room for everybody to congregate weeknights to have dinner together. We have a chef who cooks wonderful meals. And then four writers' rooms for novelists and short story writers and poets. And so at any one time, there are 10 people in residence from all over the world. Right now, we have a visual artist from Essen, a poet from Sichuan, a couple of writers, a dancer from New York, etc. They work for a month and then they go away. We pay all their expenses while they're here. They don't have to pay for food or anything. They just are juried in to have a month in this paradisical.
You ought to have somebody thing. Move in and write a history of KPFA.
Here, yeah, possibly so. Well, do you need a place to stay?
It's possible. Looking forward to the future. Do you know? You must be familiar with Schloss Solitude, just outside of Stuttgart.
I don't know that, but I know that that in Europe now a lot of these programs are starting up.
Well, this was done with absolutely major money, and the Schloss Solitude is an old Baroque Rococo castle. Just up in the hills outside of Stuttgart, and it was the summer home of the ruling monarch at the time, and it's Baden-Württemberg, I think. It was his personal sort of Sanssouci, but on a very modest scale compared with Sanssouci. But it was a real center of Germany because you stand under the dome of this thing, and the lower part of it is open in all directions, and the structure of the little palace is above it, and you look down this long straight line of a road that goes from the center of it off into infinity, mm-hmm. down and up the other side. And that was the zero mark from which German measurements were taken, that was their Greenwich Meridian line.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they would like to be that culturally. But what this had, there's this castle, and then around it a great semicircle of buildings, outbuildings, which included the stables and the residences for the servants and so forth. Well, that semicircle has been at enormous expense. You wouldn't believe the money that has gone into converting that space into a series of apartments and performance areas and galleries and a huge corridor that sweeps the whole side of it, and it's split into the middle into two, so that it's a semicircle split into two quadrants, and each one of this just this enormous sweep.
So who goes
of
there?
All.
Do they have people who are they applicants?
There are applicants, and I would say very much the same principle as
the
what
Jurassic
you have
program.
What you have here.
I'll look it up. I have a list of the international programs. I haven't heard of that one.
I'll send you. I've got one of their recent extensive brochures, because I've been there a couple of times as a
for how long
for just for a week, but as a visiting instructor, because they have artists in residence who go there and work and just do their thing for half a year or whatever, but then they have a rota of people that go through and
give workshops.
Give workshops, perform, uh-huh. what have you. I've been there twice with a wonderful trombonist named John Kenny that I work with. A lot in trombone and electronics, and including improvisation, and, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. but a commissioned repertoire as well, And I was brought in the first place by you know Hesperos,
yeah,
the sanest madman I know, whom I knew originally through through Darmstadt, when we, you know, we were both going there. He stopped, but he put my name in the year that he was in charge of the music part of the operation at Schloss Solitude, and I don't know why I'm recording myself.
It's really exciting to see that kind of concentration available, and what it does to people's ego. It makes them feel like they're valued for what they're doing, not for something else.
Having said all this, poor old Schloss Solitude has got the same problems that most places across Europe are getting these days, and when I was there for the second time last year, when John Kenny and I were both there for the second time last year, the director of the place, his energies were taken up primarily with trying to raise enough money to pay his own salary.
Mm-hmm.
Everything had changed. They were throwing money around.
Well, that's where the difference between government support and there is no nonprofit system in Europe as there is here, so people don't get a tax write-off or a significant one.
Yeah.
In Germany, you can get a little one, but not like you do here. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis for a lot of arts activity in the United States. But there's so many nonprofits now in the United States that have sprung up because of this tax advantage situation that there are too many to support. None of rich people's money to support all of them.
Is there anything else I should have asked you that I didn't ask?
My last great effort at KPFA, besides the opening of the new building, and one of my great victories was to ensure that we had a wooden floor in that performance space, not linoleum. And that was done by canvassing the staff and raising them from them $25 each. I got a lot of people to give $25 to put that floor in there. And I'm very proud of that, and also the grand piano, which is a Yamaha disc clavier.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
We went to great lengths.
That's where I did recorded all my interviews with the people, was just sitting over against one wall.
We went to great lengths to get that disc clavier by promising to do lots of things with it, which we haven't done since I've left. but my last great project was a two-hour documentary on the fountain pen, which I began to collect toward the end of my tenure at KPFA. So in February of 92, I did a two-hour program where based on interviews all around the country with experts on fountain pens, old ones particularly. And the program, which was mocked by...
You use one, if I saw it correctly.
Well, that's a rollerball. That doesn't count.
But okay.
We, Carol and I collect them. These are some of them here. But can you pull that card off?
Yeah. Good
so
Lord.
So we use these things. And,
that's wonderful. Wonderful.
And they write beautifully in a way that doesn't tire your hand out. You can write for hours with one of these things. But let me finish what I was going to say. Because if I don't, you'll interrupt me.
You've learned.
You'll have to cure yourself of this habit. The program used the sounds of handwriting, and it was based on this movie that called Prospero's Books. Did you see it?
Oh, yes.
Peter Greenaway's film.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. But
so
I know
Michael Nyman did the music, but the sound, a lot of the sound in the film is handwriting of the nib on paper, and I took the inspiration from that in the film to do to find out if you could talk about fountain pens on the radio intelligently so that people would actually get information. And it worked beautifully. We had a big success with that program, and in fact, used it as a marathon program because we gave away a KPFA fountain pen for people who called in and subscribed. And people paid a good chunk of money to get a fountain pen that said KPFA on it, which is not the most valuable kind of fountain pen you can have. You don't want anything on it because then you can't resell it. But we talked about the industrial developments that made possible the invention of a fountain pen vulcanized rubber, which would contain the ink without showing it on the exterior, to plastics and so forth. And the thing that really gave me a sense of pride was that the entire staff laughed out loud when I said I was going to do this, and they laughed even louder when I said I was going to make money on the marathon doing this program. And it turned out to be a very good documentary, and it gave me a challenge of doing something that wasn't musical or artistically oriented, but something about the pen. And I got really some great material. Fascinating interviews with people who have wonderful accents in small shops in New York, for example. And that was a fun thing to do, kind of a going away.
It turned out to be, as it were, your Festschrift.
Yeah, that's right. Right, you are. John, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate you including me in this research.
Yeah.
You've got an enormous challenge in front of you.